This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And as we always do at 9 o'clock on Friday morning, we have a conversation with somebody who is important or influential or will be or has always been on all kinds of different topics. And today's guest, it's almost impossible for you to find somebody in this country who doesn't know this name. And it almost seems silly to introduce him because he's ubiquitous. He's been everywhere and done all manner of things. So many of us hold him in enormous respect for being brave and conscientious at a time when that was hard. It was really hard. And our guest today is Peter Dirk Ace. Who else? He's an institution in this country. Stand-up comedy routines, had a rapier wit and a coruscating insight. He's been skewering politicians for decades, their ideologies and, importantly, their idiocies, whether they were intended or not, I think was part of the joy. I mean, you know, there is the man himself, and then there is his alter ego, Evita Bezadenhut, and all of her friends and relatives, on and on. And in years gone by, he's done shows on a stage, live shows with a bunch of boxes filled with props. And as the spirit moves him, he becomes something different, something unusual. But he's also run some serious national campaigns on HIV, AIDS protection and sex education, almost crusades to get public attention on things that had to be dealt with and had to be dealt with without equivocation, hiding behind bushes or something. But I must tell you, the thing I remember most about him, it was probably the first time I saw him years and years and years ago on stage. And he came out on stage just dressed in, you know, normal clothes. And he was holding a copy of a print version of the Hansard, and he turned it to a certain page and he would read the paragraph, which was a report of the number of people who had, by legislative order, managed to change their race. And he would stand there and say, and 16 people changed from color to Indian, and 2 people from Indian to white, and 4 people from Griqua to Cape Malay. And then he would stop in the middle of all this and say, I'm not making this up, you know. And he'd hold a piece of, hold the Hansard up in the air and you could see it. It's really there. You suddenly realized in a funny way, he had managed to undermine the entire edifice of what was then the prevailing apartheid ideology and architecture and governmental structure by simply reading its works to people. And it was a memorable moment for me. Peter Dirk Ace is an actor. He's a playwright, social commentator, curator and conservationist of a prior cultural history with Boracic Park. He ran around the country saving signs and benches that were marked for this person or that person because, as I remember him saying, somebody has to preserve this stuff because they're busy getting rid of it as if it was never there.
And they're getting used to the fact that it might actually make a comeback.
Ooh, that's a little dark.
Separate developments, unfortunately, reinvent themselves under different names. So yes, it's actually a full-time job. I'm very sorry that I couldn't find all the apartheid signs because I think Trevor Manuel bought them all to put into his toilet.
Oh dear. We're off to the races already.
Okay.
That's good. He's run a theater pretty much out of his home in Darling in Western Cape. And he's a novelist and he's a memoirist. A very touching and warm book that described his childhood and growing up came out a couple of years ago. I don't know if you sing or compose. I don't think I've ever heard.
I wish I could. I used to sing as a kid. I had a boy soprano voice and okay. I used to sing at weddings. My father would play the organ and I would sing. And then I got a guinea, which is £1, 1 shilling. And Pa kept the pound and I got the shilling.
Well, your sister, of course, is the musician.
She's the pianist. Yeah.
Chessa Ace, in case you're not aware. They come from the same, and she has a famous piano.
Mm.
But we're talking with him today because he has a new show, Sell By Date, at the Monte Cassino Theater. It opens, it's opening on the 24th of August, which is
Thursday.
So it's already opened, actually. You opened last night.
Yep,
it runs for 2 more weeks. And I don't know what else to say about you. There's too much.
I'm fascinated by listening. I just think, who's he talking about?
You know all that.
No, actually, I didn't have time to go there. That I put it in a box and it's there for somebody else to find.
Well, as he argues, he's not retiring. He's being retreaded.
Yeah, I think retirement is such an awful thing to force onto somebody. I mean, I remember how my favorite teacher at school came to a certain age and she had to retire. I think she was 55 in those days. And I thought, why has she gone away? She was the only one who really sort of made sense of life. Great inspiration. I just say to people now, I mean, you retire. Bricks have just arrived.
Yes.
We have this bricks look in the sky.
Well, that's probably a plane landing. As we record this, it's probably a plane landing at Lanseria.
With one of the minor bricks, the major bricks land at Oatamba.
Or Portugal.
Oh, yeah.
This was probably one of the lesser deities.
The lesser ones, yes.
Sorry,
yes.
We interrupt you.
We were completely interrupted by the reality of life. I try and keep my material as topical as possible so that actually when I'm on stage, like I'll be on stage tonight, I have to really, truly give my audience the feeling that yesterday bricks was in full swing. And that Evita is in a terrible state because she was going to cook for reconciliation, but then all the bricks brought their own chefs.
Just in case.
Just in case. And they've taken over her kitchen in the Tully House, so she's a cross lady.
Were they their own chefs by choice because they wanted national foods, or is this a question of food tasters?
Yep, they didn't like the idea of a white Afrikaans woman who was a member of the ANC cooking food for them before that she had apologized for apartheid in 5 their languages. I mean, I know it sounds so wonderful. I wish it could happen like that.
Yeah, why don't it be kind of fun? There you are. You could do the whole thing with a kitchen counter in front of you and pots and pans.
Absolutely. And feed them. And actually, that's the whole point. You know, I really believe that people sit around a table, even people who don't like each other, and eat good food and have good wine and suddenly find out that they love the same thing. The ANC and the National Party were in love with the same thing, but from different sides. And it wasn't a bloody civil war when 1994 happened, and that's one thing I keep on reminding the world.
The doomsayers had all kinds of scenarios about street fighting and
stocking up on tins of tuna. I don't even remember that.
When we bought our house in Johannesburg, it had a safe built into the wall, big enough to walk into.
Yeah,
which was clearly for weapons and tin tuna and baked beans.
And all the things, yeah.
Mm. We cut the door off so that we could use the storage space, but it was quite clear what it was all about. Mm. And this had a door that must have weighed a ton to get out of the house.
Yeah, the tornado of democracy. Yeah. Threatened.
You've been in a creative mode or in a theatrical career. It goes back to the very early 70s. You went to UCT and then you did work at the Space Theatre.
Well, before the Space, I was in London for 4 years at the London Film School.
That's right.
Which was a very, very important development for me. Because that's when I really, for the first time, saw the BBC documentaries about apartheid in South Africa, not believing what I saw. Because as I said to my friends at the film school, no, it's communism, it's lies. Until I found out that it wasn't lies. And I had to really restructure my alphabet of survival by trying to find the truth. And that was a very important 4 years in my life.
And then you came back to Cape Town?
To the Space Theatre.
Okay. Which was newly opened.
Literally opened. And Brian Asprey and Yvonne Briceland sent me a postcard of Table Mountain, which didn't help. I was so homesick. And they said, we're opening a theatre, which is non-racial theatre. You know, nowadays I could explain to an audience what it means when I say non-racial. And when I say it meant that only white people could go to something, half that audience laughs. South African audience of people under 30 who have no idea what it means.
How could that be?
It was just extraordinary. And I was there for 2 years, and that was also a major, major development for me. Because the one thing that I discovered was humor. Nothing was funny. You know, comedy is about the joke. But humor is what everybody has, a sense of humor. Laughing at fear. And when my plays were banned by the censor board, it was a terrible experience because the actors in the play were being terrorized at home by their families. They were being shouted at church when they went there because they were involved with a pornographic piece of theater, which was communist inspired and all that. And we really didn't know how to handle it until we saw page 4 of the letter from the censor board. And all the so-called swear words in the play, and I kept on saying, but this is dialogue. No, we people don't talk like this. A typist had typed out all the swear words. There they were. It was the fun. And we screamed with laughter. This Calvinist lady was sitting there typing out all these wonderful Afrikaans swear words. And that really, truly gave me the inspiration to always have a balance in my work of 49% anger and 51% entertainment.
That was going to lead me to my next question, but we're going to take a very quick station break, and we'll be right back with Peter Derkace, who actually needs no further introduction. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous to try. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector and The Deep Dive, and we are sitting in a sunny garden room with none other than Peter Derkace. It's a delight to have you here. As we were moving to a station break, he was busy explaining that the censor board had issued a notice explaining all the words that they couldn't use, but had typed them out so that you couldn't be mistaken about what it was that had to be there.
And we put that onto the wall in the men's toilet of the Space Theater, and the men laughed louder at that than they laughed at the plays. And it was wonderful. It was a really changing moment for many people who were also frightened. I mean, fear is always the weapon of destruction, especially now, but even in those days. And I've kept all those things. That's wonderful. I keep those.
That would have been my next question. Do you have this stuff?
I have everything. I've kept everything. Just instinctively, I just thought, don't throw this away. It's just too good to be true. People won't believe me. Well, first of all, it is proof of the madness. And what I've been doing since lockdown, which was another extraordinary moment in my life, in everybody's lives, when for nearly 2 years you just had to look at the cat and hope that the world would survive. I put all my reviews, the review sketches and texts, I couldn't put on my website because my pay scripts are there. But a review that was done in 1981 being read 2024 doesn't really make sense. So you've got to give it a backstory.
Yeah.
And so I had time to do that. And when I did the backstory on the characters that I was playing, I thought I have to do another backstory on apartheid's obscenity and absurdity. You had to explain putting the pencil through somebody's hair to decide what ethnic group they belong to. And then I found out I had 488 pages. And of course, during lockdown, nobody at my publishing company was even thinking of publishing a book. So I put it into my website. So it's been there free. And the second volume is also there now, which is about the Mandela years. And that's also been going back into all those boxes and files and just finding out enormous things that I'd forgotten about. The funny things, but also shocking things. And the worst thing is I suddenly realized the fear has not gone away. Apartheid is not here, but separate development is here.
Find what you mean.
What I mean is people are still being divided. There's BEE, which is dividing the nation. There are all sorts of ethnic things are dividing people. There is not an encouragement of people to say, share with each other, which we don't know about each other. I mean, if you have people living next door with a different language to yours, find out what it is. Find out a few words and say to them in those words. But it's not happening, and we are allowing the walls to get higher, and people don't trust each other anymore and are frightened by politics.
My feeling was always that money drives people apart, but it also drives people together. And I had a proposal in the U.S. years and years ago, because the tax system is used for social engineering. It always has been. I said, what if we had a tax deduction if you could prove you had a neighbor of a different race?
I think it's a great idea.
Here, I think it would work splendidly.
But also make a tax deduction if you have more than two official languages.
That's a thought, too.
Because we have English and Afrikaans, but Xhosa we don't have. Zulu we don't have. Of course, now they have sign language, which is very easy to learn because all you use is your third finger up in the air.
We can't show that, but you can imagine it, folks. You can imagine it. We're speaking with Peter Derkace, who, of course, needs no introductory paragraph or line or anything else. What was the precipitating mechanism that made you move from acting? I mean, we've talked about this notice from the censor board, but what was it who drove you from acting per se to satire? I don't want to call it comedy because it's not really comedy. It's social satire because it always had a wicked little hook in it.
First of all, I was going to go to university to become a teacher. Mm. I wanted to be a teacher like I had a teacher at school who changed my life by saying to me, write me a poem in English. This was an Afrikaans school. And I said, no, Miss Nell, I can't. She said, yes, you can. And I said, no, I don't know how. She said, Peter, you can do anything. If you believe in it and work towards it, you can do anything. And I wanted to be that teacher that also said that to a frightened child. So there I was getting to register at UCT for my BA. And I saw at the table next to my table, a girl in a beautiful beret with sunglasses and a long cigarette holder. And I thought, like, I want to look like that in the world. It's too beautiful. So I went across and said, what are you going to do? She said, darling, I'm going to do theater. I'm signing up to do drama, to be a drama. So I signed up to do be a drama. My father hit the roof. My father threw me out of the house. He was so angry.
Man of the old school, as you
well, know. Yes, of course. You don't get angry. And so I was at drama school for 4 years. And they actually said to me, that the lecturer said, you know, you don't really have much talent. You should become a stage manager. So I did, because I always believed everything adults said. And that was a fantastic grounding for me, because I now am a stage manager who writes, who acts, who makes his own dresses and wears them, and travels around the world without an entourage. But I never thought of writing specifically. I just went where the instinct took me. And when I finished my BA drama, I wanted to study further, and I wanted to study in London, because of English theatre, because of all the various things, including the cultural boycott, which had left us so bereft of answers to the questions we had. And then, of course, when I got to London and I heard the way English people speak English, I thought, no, I can't compete with that. And then I found the London Film School. And that's where my writing started, writing scripts for films, writing structures. And I wrote my first play. It popped out. I was actually writing a letter to a friend in Cape Town. And this was 1968, 67, around there. And this letter started as a play. Peter sits in the kitchen. It is very, very cold. And suddenly characters walked into my story. And there I had a play. And it was amazing, because it was, again, a door opened for me. And there I was in the center of London theatre. I put my play on in the film school during the 3 months vacation. And the principal said to me, well, Peter, you know, we haven't got any seats in the cinema. I don't know if you can get me seats, then you can put on your play. Because it was in Covent Garden, behind the Cambridge Theatre, so in the center of London. So I wrote 15 letters to people who I thought would help me. And I got 2 letters back, one from the Duchess of Bedford, who sent me £100, and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who sent me £100. And in those years, £200 was enough to buy 40 cinema seats, screw them down on the floor, and voila, I had my theatre.
They're probably still there.
I wonder if they're still there. The film school is still there. Yeah. I think they've got more fancy theatres now.
Better seats now. Okay, yeah. But someday you're going to track down what happened to your seats.
Where are my seats?
Yeah.
Well, I have some seats at home that somebody gave me from a place that changed. I think it was, where was it in Cape Town? One, maybe it could have been the Baxter that changed some seats for, and I've got a whole row of them, which I also like.
I should remember the Market Theatre got its original seating from an old movie theatre.
Yep, these are also from a movie theatre. Yeah.
And they've only, in the last 8-9 years, did they change.
Yeah, that's right. I remember those seats too.
Yeah, some of them were good.
Snap up.
Yes, some of them didn't do anything. So I just sort of sit there. But how did you find your satiric voice? That's a little different than the playwriter's instinct.
I don't know about the, never thought of that. I never actually understood what I was doing. I just knew I had to do it. My first stories that I put into my first 4 plays was about sexual confusion. I mean, being gay and not knowing how to actually even admit it, because even in London during those years, it was a criminal offense to be homosexual. And when I came back to the Market Theatre, to the Space Theatre, and my first play in Afrikaans, because again, I needed to write languages that irritated the government, and Afrikaans was the language. English was, oh well, that's a bad language for, I mean, they just invaders, the English, the Engelsers, and so I had my first play with a young man who is having an affair with an actress, a famous Afrikaans actress, older than him, a toy boy, and he, the toy boy, has a boyfriend, and the boyfriend has got a girlfriend. Ha ha. Very topical today.
The possibilities are
And that was one of the plays that was banned.
Okay.
So that.
Banned for sex, banned for life.
Yes, I think in retrospect, you banned it for the fact that the girlfriend of the boyfriend, a young boy, could have been mixed race. So we were crossing those lines. And that's where I suddenly realized that I have to use all these forbidden areas to go in and exploit them and make not fun, but make the audience actually understand how these characters were going to solve them. And that's where the word satire, which I had to actually find the definition through Lenny Bruce, who defined satire as tragedy plus time equals satire.
That's further down on my question.
But of course, it can't work in South Africa because there's too much tragedy and no time. Mm. So the horror of today has got to be reflected in the evening show.
You're making a what I think is a crucial distinction between comedy and satire.
Comedy and humor.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Huge, huge, huge difference for me. I mean, comedy is wonderful. Jokes. I love jokes. I can't remember the line. I would start with a punchline, so that doesn't work. But humor is absurdity, the absurdity, the ironies, the shocking reality of, I mean, you just analyze what ruled South Africa for so many years, this terrible system of apartheid, which I'm sure in the beginning irritated some decent white people hugely, but eventually they got used to it. Like we have now got used to blackouts in this country, that the lights go out and businesses are collapsing and we're just thinking, oh, well, you know, that's the way it is. Well, it's not the way it is.
It's the frog on the stove in the pot with the water slowly getting warmer.
Yeah, it is. But I want people to recognize what it is, but also recognize it with humor, meaning again, laughing at fear. I keep on saying fear is the most dangerous reality in our lives because most people see something and say, I don't want to know. Let's not talk about this. So we don't talk about it. And in your memory and your mind, it becomes huge. Like a monster, you'll never confront. But when you actually confront that fear, it'll never be taller than you. It's very lethal. It can kill you. But if you have your eye on it, you can be in charge of that fear. And that's what I conjure with at the moment still.
Aristotle, remember him?
A very nice man. I like him. Also a sexual deviant, but very nice man.
He wrote stuff.
He did.
When he tried to describe the difference between tragedy and comedy. And he said, tragedy initially imitates men who are better than the average, and comedy imitates men who are worse.
I love that. Mm. I love it. And I would just like to change something in that. It's the word men. I would put the word me. Me. Yeah. No, oh. Me. If I can put myself into the position of being a good echo or a bad echo, I find that much more real. And I think then the story will work for the people who are listening because it's all about stories.
We have to take another break, mm-hmm. and we're speaking with Peter Derkes. It's Brooke Spector here at the Deep Dive, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and I'm sitting in our sunroom kitchen, bright sunny day, cup of coffee. And we are speaking with one of the few people in this country who absolutely needs no introduction, Peter Derkes. Years ago, when you did your lacerating critiques of the old regime, mm-hmm. Nobody was spared, not even the people who said, nah, it's sort of, well, okay. It was dangerous, but it was really easy to do in a way because the jokes almost wrote themselves. I mean, whatever they said became in the harsher light. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
But how to critique the new overlords? Is it harder?
Is it harder? It was...
Or more dangerous?
Well, it's a very important word to use about now. It's very dangerous. But really, truly, I did not, during those apartheid years, I did not think we would survive as a nation, a decent nation. I really thought the bloodbath is coming. Cambodia is on its way, and it was really a chilling experience to sort of see the strength and the way people were forgetting and the only way that it could remain in the conversation was through the humor, through the joke, the quote unquote joke. Then suddenly came this extraordinary experience where a man came out of 27 years in the darkness of jail and gave us light. And of course, Eskom had given up, but we had light.
Still electricity.
And suddenly there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And again, I've heard to say it today, the light at the end of the tunnel belongs to Eskom. So there's nothing to look forward to, but really, truly, I was so excited and so relieved and so determined not to miss out on the small details of people's renaissance, how people who were brought up to believe that they were superior suddenly had to realize over a cup of coffee that doesn't work anymore. And so, yeah, it was a wonderful honeymoon with this wonderful group of people who came out of exile with a fabulous sense of humor. And the most exciting thing that I did manage to do was in 1994, a few months after the democracy, a TV a series called Funny Galore by Evita Besaidner, the most famous white woman in South Africa, as she was then known as, surprisingly, interviewed the new government, interviewed the ex-communists, the ex-terrorists, all the people who were the whites and the coloreds and the
Is that archived anywhere?
It's on YouTube. All of them are on YouTube.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. They are all on YouTube. The interview with Nelson Mandela, Evita Besaidner with Nelson Mandela, Evita Besaidner with Cyril Ramaphosa, catching trout. And he was magnificent. They were all. Finley Jewala, our Speaker of Parliament, in a sari. She had a sari for Evita. She put the sari around Evita in Parliament under the picture portrait of P.W. Botha. It's just extraordinary, extraordinary experience. And nobody asked me for questions. Nobody said, we have lawyers, we have agents, we are a government. Please tell us what you're going to ask. Nobody did. We just said, take Evita on a trip. Take her somewhere that you want to have fun with her. Jay Naidu took her dancing. He couldn't do the tango, so Evita must come and do the tango. So we did the tango together. And in fact, when we were rehearsing the tango together,
I will be looking all this
up. It was extraordinary. He said, I've never done the tango before. I said, you have never danced with a man in a dress before. He said, I've forgotten. You're right, I've forgotten. And so I have had a very interesting honeymoon, maybe too long with democracy, maybe too long. But then came Thabo Mbeki with his denials, which meant that my pencil got sharper and sharper and my anger got very, very...
I was going to say there was a turning point somewhere.
It was there. And then, of course, Jacob Zuma. And I thought, oh, my goodness, because suddenly there was Donald Trump on the other side of the world. And I thought, oh, my goodness, is this what we're in for now? And I'm afraid we are still there. And the danger is very, very definite. And I've also had to reinvent myself constantly. I mean, COVID was an extraordinary horror story, but also a very important full stop where I had time to just think, where do I fit in here? I'm now 77.
You're a young man.
Yes, I am. But I am still a white South African with criticism about black politics, and that doesn't work anymore. A white criticism of black action doesn't work because the reaction to that is you're a racist and you can't go beyond that.
I was going to ask you, and you just brought it right to focus. In an earlier time for you to tackle P.W. Botha was, I mean, your face is relatively plastic. It was easy enough to do.
And we belong to the same tribe.
And you knew the tics and the mannerisms and the nonverbal cues.
And also there by the grace of God go I. I mean, he was, well, the first apartheid prime minister was a cousin of my father, Dr. Diep Menon. You know, So I felt I had the right to do and say whatever. And basically, I think I just wanted to irritate them. I wanted to piss them off.
You had standing.
And I really succeeded hugely. Even my father kicked me out of the house eventually.
But it must be more awkward, difficult, delicate, unnerving to try to apply the same sort of tactic to a Julius Malema.
No. It is a rethink, a very, very careful rethink. Most of the characters I did in the apartheid era had to be done, and they were politicians, and the laughter was very important. It sort of tore their pants open and one could kick their bums. There were some of the politicians that I really disliked so intensely that I didn't do them. Eugène Tablanche, I just didn't think he was worth the energy, so I didn't do him. When it comes to politics today, I think Julius Malema is a riveting character to talk about and to remind an audience that if they had the time to read a book about Germany 1929, they will also read about a Nazi party that everybody laughed at and everybody thought they were funny and this man with a moustache, idiot. And then the Depression came and everybody lost their money and this funny little party suddenly became the ruling party of Germany and Adolf Hitler became the deputy, the chancellor of the government. You know, so I'm looking ahead here to next year's election. And I really hope we will not have a coalition between the ANC and the EFF because then we will have the Hitler-Hindenburg situation. But I am really very, very sad that I can't do the politicians, the black politicians, with as much gusto as I did David Mtutu because he asked me in 1985, Peter, why am I not in your show? And Nelson Mandela laughed first, and he, you know, and to me they didn't have color. I mean, even Winnie Mandela sent me a beautiful photograph of herself with her beautiful Khoza drag on the picture she wrote, "Dear Mr. Ace," this was 1985, "Dear Mr. Ace, the day you drew me on stage, please look like this." Sense of humor. The government of 1984 had a wonderful sense of humor, which you will see in the funny little interviews.
1994.
Did I say 1994?
You said 1984.
No, 84. No, God,
You frightened me there for a second. 94.
But again, let's go back to 1984. There were one or two of the enemy who were actually on my side. Dr. Pete Kurnoff was a fan. He was the minister of everything. He was the ambassador to the United States of America. He then proved to the world that apartheid could never work because second in command of the National Party had a relationship with a woman of color. I mean, hello, I couldn't make that up if I tried.
No.
But there were, so there were people, and Pugburto, Minister of Foreign Affairs, of course, when Evita Bisset became the ambassador to the black homeland of Babitiko Sweti, he was her boss. And so we spread a rumor that he was having an affair with Evita Bisset. The trouble is he started believing it. And I have faxes that he sent her in 1986, which in the middle of the night, 7-page faxes, "Evita, my darling, my dearest, Evita, you're..." And I mean, obviously, after 3 bottles of others.
There's a lot of clip drifting in there.
So there was also a sense of humor that was dangerous because I couldn't relax into it. I had to be careful.
We're speaking with Peter Dirk-Ace. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And I want to talk about comic forebears for a second. And you mentioned briefly one. You speak about Lenny Bruce?
Lenny Bruce, yes, yeah. Yes.
But there's some other people that come to my mind, too. Robert Kirby.
Oh, absolutely. Robert Kirby, very important.
South African, little bit older than you are, by about 6-7 years, I guess.
He was a wonderful inspiration because he hated everything I did.
He was funny,
really, but brilliant. He used words so spectacularly. In fact, I did a TV series called Going Down Gorgeous with Noel Fine, my Jewish African princess. Mm. Noel Fine, you know Noel Fine. And he reviewed it and he just hated it so much. And his review was so appalling that it looked like a rave review.
Maybe he meant that.
No, he didn't mean that. But I really enjoyed his venom. I thought I was really being attacked by somebody who also knew the alphabet of satire. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very viciously funny. I could never go there. I really couldn't do that because I really had to find some way of seeing the humanity in the people that I was fighting against. And he attacked me, said, "You with your compassionate satire." I loved all that.
We're going to take another quick break. We're speaking with Peter Dirk-Ace. This is Brooke Spector and The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is Brooke Spector, and I'm with The Deep Dive, of course, every Friday morning, and we're speaking to one of my favorite people, a guest who quite literally needs no introduction, Peter Dirk-Ace. Although he has a new show open, which has now already opened at Monte Cassino, which is called Sell By Date. We were talking about Robert Kirby just before we took a break. I went out and looked up Robert Kirby because he was the first comedian satirist I heard in this country in a little club in Hillbrow in 1975 where he did something with handkerchiefs that had different spots and colors, and he was busy explaining separate development with handkerchiefs that would be pulled out of different pockets. And it was too bizarre to explain to people who didn't know anything about the country. Yeah. But if you did, it was like, whoa, who let him loose? Kirby said, "You can't have humor without offending somebody. Every joke offends somebody down the line. Humor that didn't plunge the knife into somebody's ribs would be terribly pale, vapid, and weak."
That's exactly what I expected him to say. Hmm. And he did it brilliantly. I want to offend everybody because offending means I've rattled their political cage. I don't want to demean them. I don't want to insult them. Robert really tore pieces. You have so much power on that stage. You can do it. And he did it. And I'll never forget, I was in a performance of a friend of mine who was a stand-up comedian. And he picked on a woman in the front row. And he made jokes about her hair. And he said, and he kept on. And at interval, I saw her in tears. And I realized that she had just come out of hospital with cancer. And this was a wig she was wearing. And this comedian, and I went backstage during that interval and I said to him, do you know what you've done? And he was horrified. I said, that's too late. You don't do that.
You don't undo that.
You don't do that. No, you just don't do that. But Kirby did it and
he mostly got away with it.
I miss that and miss him, but I miss the challenge that he was in my life. He really forced me to look at my weapons of action. And yeah.
There are three Americans who come to mind when I think about your work. Mort Saul.
Now, that was an interesting. I was at the festival, Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. And I was on a bill with Mort Saul, was the big star. And I was on with two other satirists. And I had a little, like a 10-minute piece. And they had each a 10-minute piece, so we were like 30 minutes, and then Mort Saul would go on as long as it. And I was terrified. I mean, I thought, oh my God, oh my God, oh yeah. The young woman was terrified, we all. And we did our little piece, and then he did his piece. They'd asked him to do a bar audience at the end with us three, and he refused. He walked off. And he said, I'm not going on with these people, you must get rid of them. So we thought, obviously, we did better than he did. And as a result, we each got half an hour of material to do because Mort Saul couldn't take the joke. And I did a lot of research on him and I thought to myself, well, yeah, I think he's taking himself very seriously. I think what he did was extraordinary and the Americans really needed him and understood more or less what he was doing. I'll never forget that extraordinary, extraordinary experience.
And the other two, Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen.
Well, Lenny Bruce, I'm more interested in how he committed suicide, literally committed suicide on stage by repeating what has happened to him, what the censor board had done to him, what the government had done to him and the police. And the lesson I learned from that is don't become a victim of your failures and your blood. Don't let the blood flow and cry because you are, look what they've done to me. So I did a lot of research.
Not become a Pagliacci.
No, no. I did a lot of research on him and I did some quick reading. I didn't want to copy him. But then, but Woody Allen, I just loved the storytelling. It was so marvelous.
It's not a joke at all. It's a story that we have no idea where it's going.
Great humanity and great understanding and made the people around him international figures, the families, the men and women, and his touch. And of course, great. I've always enjoyed. And I do this now. I've got most of his films on DVD. I've still got a DVD machine that works. Hello. what are they doing to my old age? I thought I'd have all these things to watch. And without a DVD player, you can't see them anymore.
Hey, we still have a VHS.
Oh, video geez, so have I. So have I. I've got two. I mean, somebody just said, buy the spares. But I've been watching, I keep on watching the Woody Allen things and I enjoy it very much. I love his work.
Contemporary South African comedian stroke satirists. Who do you like now?
Well, first of all, who I miss is Dame Edna Everidge, who yeah. I actually, he
was well, not really South African.
No. I mean, she was probably the greatest influence on me.
That was that was the next name on my list.
Really? Because he, quite frankly, was a major influence on me and his work in the '50s. The characters he did then, when there was no joke, they were bitter and angry and frightening.
He kind of mellowed.
Oh yeah, well, look, you want to make money, you mellow. Mm. You want to make money, you got to mellow. Okay. but Barry Humphries really, truly also, it was a tremendous amount of lessons for me. And the thing is, of course, my Evita Bisignat was hugely influenced by Dame Edna Everidge. But the one thing I knew immediately was, there's no copying here. Edna Everidge is a housewife, superstar. She's a social beast. Evita Bisignat is a political animal. And political animal, in her case, was someone with utter sense of humor. Dame Edna had a wonderful sense of humor. And she knew exactly how to nudge, nudge, wink, wink, know what I mean. Whereas Evita Bisignat doesn't know why people are laughing, but she thinks it's quite sweet. And she has no sense of irony. So that's why these two monsters could really get on with what they had to do without cancelling each other out.
Might have been interesting to have an evening with.
We talked, it never happened.
That's a shame.
Very, very shame. I was very sorry. I would have loved it. Because Evita would have been very uncomfortable with a man in a dress. Very uncomfortable. And my, she hasn't got any bosoms, doesn't know what's going on. And of course, can you imagine In fact, I now say in my show, which opened last night, I talk about the women in my life, the extraordinary women who influenced me, Sophia Loren, Marlene Dietrich, Dame Edna Everidge, who I will never forgive for being funnier than Evita Peseyner, because she was.
Anna Russell.
Oh, I loved Anna Russell. I was such a little boy and I never realized why one was laughing at somebody about music. And then the other man who also, I've forgotten his name now. That's what happens at 77.
I have to put a little post-it on my chest to remind me who I am when I wake up. So no, don't feel bad.
He was a Swedish man, I think, or Danish man who also played the piano.
Yeah, no, Victor Borg.
Oh, go Victor Borg. I loved them. I didn't realize that one could make fun of such serious things. I think that also helped me.
Yeah, well,
Anna Russell, I adored Anna Russell.
Victor Borg actually arrived in New York City penniless and realized that he was never going to break into the top ranks as a concert pianist, and his accent was his best weapon.
And look what a marvelous weapon it was. Oh, it was great.
And his vocalized pronunciation was his first real
phonetic punctuation.
Yeah,
marvelous.
The thing that, you know, that you can watch it now, and you've seen it, you know, 50, 100
yes.
times, you still laugh.
And Anna Russell, you could still play your LP. I've got an LP player and I can play my LP. No, these great people who mustn't be forgotten. I mean, really, truly, they are. You know, but then there's Joan Rivers as well, who in her extraordinary way also had a wonderful satirical tongue in one's cheek. And I miss her because she also managed to take that. She was like the beginning of where social media was going to take comedy and humor.
Quickly now, South African satirists and comedians that you think we need now and can watch with not just pleasure, but with where we can learn.
Well, I'm not quite sure because I don't have much time to go to people's shows. In Johannesburg, I can see more of the young performers. I've tried to use the young ones when I was in beginning of the century. I did another series. Evita did a series for ENCA. I got a satirist who had never performed in public or in sitting on the television, Mark Lottering being one of them, Marianne Tum. And I said, I'm giving you 10 minutes. She said, well, do you want me to show what I do? I said, I'm not auditioning you. If you make a mess, you have made a mess.
No problem.
And you will live with it for the rest of your life. None of them made a mess. They were wonderful. And I love what I see. I'm not going to mention the names now because I can't mention everybody's names.
Sure, I understand.
But I'm very serious when I talk to them and I say, listen, you have got to realize if you're going to mess around with politics, especially with politics and racism and all the things that are now being cooked up to shut people up as well, you've got to be prepared to lose your life. Are you prepared to lose your life? Because if you're not, get out of the way. I am prepared, and I was right from the beginning. I just had to know I cannot do certain things for the simple reason it would kill my father and it damaged my sister, because he had already been told by someone in government, you must control your children, Hannes. Your sister, your daughter is in London. We can make life very uncomfortable for her. I mean, that.
That's pretty mean-spirited.
That's appalling. Appalling. I just say to them, find your anger and write a sketch making your anger ridiculous. And that's where you can start.
That is a perfect way to end this.
Okay.
That is exactly what I hope you could do for me.
Good.
We've been speaking with the inimitable, the inevitable, the universally appreciated and loved Peter Dirkace. His new show, Sell By Dates, running now at Monte Cassino. Go see it. He says he's 77 years old, but he doesn't look a day over 50.
Ah, it works.
Or 60.
Baby oil works. Take it off your makeup and you've got a baby's bum for a face, yes.
This has been a rare pleasure. It really has been. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you. I've loved it. Thank you.
And this is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be back next week, Friday morning, at 9, and maybe we'll take a serious look at the BRICS summit, or maybe it'll be an unserious look. I'm not sure yet. Depends on who we get to come in to do it for us. Anyway, tune in again next week at 9 o'clock on this station. We'll be with you.